Again, my name is Paul Terry, and I represent the Sedona Condominium Homeowners Association. In oral argument this morning, I'd like to address two primary issues. The first is the definition of a new residence under the West Park decision of this court. And second of all, the issue of the requirement of vertical privity for the implied warranty, which was addressed largely under the Lofts of Fillmore case out of the Arizona Supreme Court. Turning first to the West Park decision, Justice Maupin, in drafting that opinion, pointed out, and I think correctly so, that the definition of a new residence cannot be resolved under a plain reading of NRS 40.615. And so Justice Maupin pointed out that what we really need to do is we need to look at the spirit intent of the law and make sure we avoid absurd results. And in the context of West Park, certainly saying that a seven-year-old apartment project wasn't new, or to try to call it new, would be absurd, I think makes a lot of sense. However, there are other situations in which perhaps it doesn't make sense, and although the first half of this case was decided before some of these facts were actually in the record, the issue is still there, which is, does the rule that arose out of West Park mean that a project that has been occupied as an apartment, for example, for as little as one day, automatically become...
Are you alleging that's what happened here?
Well,
did you argue that that straw man situation was certainly one of the concerns of the court when we did West Park? Was that argued?
That was not argued as part of the Camden part of the case. The point was simply conceded, and they looked to vertical privity at that point, you know.
Right.
That was before my office was involved. However, that issue was clearly raised with respect to the Delta Harbor defendants. And in fact, that is the argument. To the extent there is evidence, we think the evidence is questionable, but it was 28 days was the shortest one. So the question then would be, is 28 days sufficient? Now, nobody can argue that there was malfeasance here because the West Park decision didn't exist at the time, so somebody can't argue that's what occurred intentionally, but functionally that is what occurred, is that to the extent they were occupied at all, it was in many cases for a very short period of time. And so really the point I want to make to the court is, does the West Park decision produce absurd results when you talk about a living unit that's been occupied for a month or for 2 months?
Well, how many of them were occupied for a month? I think that seemed to be kind of a question. There was an indication there were 96 or 98% of them that were occupied, and to my knowledge, there wasn't an indication that any of them were occupied for a month or 2 months.
Was that just a point of argument,
or do you have evidence?
There was one that was occupied for, okay, back up. First off, we're talking about rent rolls. We don't actually know whether or not they were actually occupied. We know that there was a lease, some short-term leases. Whether they were actually occupied and for what period of time, we don't know. But certainly we know from the rent rolls that there was at least one that was 28 days. There were several that were 29 days. There were several that were a month. There were a bunch that were 2 months. There were a bunch that were 3 months.
How much is a bunch?
We spelled out the numbers precisely in the brief. I don't have those.
One of the issues for us is by using rent roll versus occupied, it does make a difference in looking at the two cases have been cited as to new residents. One helps us, one doesn't help us. But more importantly, I guess I would like an answer to the basic question. The issue is whether or not arguments pursuant to Chapter 40 have basically been waived and you're strictly proceeding under economic loss.
And Your Honor, my response would be no, they're not. It is true that counsel chose... They didn't withdraw it. They forced the motion to be made, and they simply conceded because of the language in the West Park decision that they were not going to oppose it, and so they allowed the ruling to be made, which therefore means it can be appealed. So I don't think it was waived. I don't think they ever withdrew those claims. They simply allowed the court to rule on the motion.
But counsel, you're saying counsel conceded it, and now you want to appeal his concession?
Well, it wasn't a concession. It was just a notice of,
when there's a non-opposition pursuant to the local rules, I think it's 2.20, you're conceding that the motion itself is meritorious.
Well, I, well.
So It's kind of a circular argument.
It is a circular argument. Under the plain reading of the way West Park was written, I think that that's true. However, I think that West Park is subject at least to exploring whether or not that it really works, because in the context of a seven-year-old apartment project, it's an absurd result. I concede that. But in the context of an apartment project that's been occupied for less than a year, in some cases very short periods of time, I would submit that you get an absurd result by saying that that's not a new residence. The way to bring that in front of the Supreme Court is to get a ruling and then move on. Yes, they could have filed more, but I think they did preserve it simply by forcing the motion to be made and not simply withdrawing. Again, what I would suggest to this court is, rather than adopt a bright line rule, which
we actually left it pretty flexible. We didn't adopt a real bright line rule for this specific purpose. So as these cases come up, we can address them on a case by case basis and determine what perhaps might be a straw man situation.
Well, I don't know that the court share that interpretation. I believe Judge Johnson did, in fact, indicate in oral argument that it was, in fact, she did view it as a bright-line rule. It's either a yes or a no. What I would submit to the court is exactly what Your Honor is suggesting, and that's that there should be looked on a case-by-case basis, and is it truly a new residence? In the case of a seven-year-old apartment project, it's easy. No, it's not. In the case of something that's been occupied or leased for a year or less, which we believe applies to most of them based on the rent rolls, we don't have any information as to how often any of them were actually occupied, although presumably they were occupied to some degree. But
do you have an opportunity to discovery on that?
Well, we were a little late to the case, Your Honor, but no discovery was done on that. No information arose until the rent rolls were produced in a motion for summary judgment. That was the first time there was any evidence in the case that there was any occupancy. And no, we did request additional discovery at that time, and the court declined to order it, indicating the case had already been pending for as long as it had. But, yes, we did expressly request that at argument to try and pin down exactly who exactly some of these renters were, because if you notice in the brief, a number of those renters were not individuals, they're companies. And we don't know how long, if any of these were actually rented or occupied, and so we don't have that information, which is really one of the reasons why we argued to the trial court that it wasn't ripe for summary judgment. But that's really kind of the second half of our argument here. Let me turn, if I could, to the issue of vertical privity, and in particular, when this case was argued in the trial court, one of the primary authorities that was relied upon was an appellate decision out of Arizona called Lost at Fillmore. In the time between when the trial court decided that case and it came up here, the Supreme Court accepted review and heard that case and has now reversed the appellate court, finding that, at least in the state of Arizona, vertical privity is no longer required. So that's really a fundamental change between what the trial court dealt with and what is before this court. And I also wanted to point out Justice Maupin's concurring opinion in the Callaway case, in which he suggested that although it wasn't ripe in that particular case, that when an appropriate case came along, it might be appropriate for this court to consider whether we're going to withdraw the requirement of vertical privity in the case of residential housing. And I think this is the case for that, where you have clearly significant defects that were identified. It really would be unfair, I think, to hold the ultimate buyers of those homes responsible for correcting all of these construction defects when there were, at least allegedly, very serious code violations and violations of workmanship standards and the like. And this would be, I think, an appropriate case for this court to extend the ruling in Hiles v. Johnson Pump to remove the requirement of vertical privity in the case of residential housing. I do know that in the papers, one of the arguments is that this really isn't residential housing. It's a commercial apartment project. But this court really addressed the difference between apartments and condominiums in the West Park case and really rejected any distinction between them. It's all residential housing. And certainly My clients in this case are individuals who bought these homes and expected to live in them and use them. And I submit that this is an appropriate case. One of the arguments, I think, for not allowing just any kind of a recovery, the economic loss rule, is because it subjects a builder to potentially unlimited kinds of damages because of the nature of tort remedies. However, what I'm suggesting in this case is simply removing the requirement of vertical privity, so all we're talking about is the implied warranty of habitability in this state. And it's, at least since the days of Hadley v. Baxendale, the issue of the foreseeability of damages has been very limited when we're talking about a contract issue versus when we're talking about a tort issue. And so if this court does decide that it wants to remove the requirement of vertical privity, we're not simply opening the floodgates. We're simply saying this just has to do with contractual remedies, not tort remedies. And that's what I submit would be appropriate in this case. Unless the court has other questions, I'll defer. Yeah.
Leaves you with about 407.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brian Wright, and I'm here on behalf of the Camden respondents. This court should affirm the 2008 dismissal of Camden for four clear reasons. The first is that the undisputed evidence presented by both parties to the trial court in 2006 and 2007 demonstrated that these units were built as commercial apartment complexes and occupied prior to the point of their conversion and sale to the public. Second reason, Sedona has never presented any evidence to demonstrate that the trial court's factual determination in 2007 that these units were occupied was clearly erroneous. In fact, to this day, Sedona can't point to any evidence to demonstrate that these units were not occupied as apartments prior to their sale as condominiums.
Well, I thought he said there were a bunch of them in there that indicated they probably weren't occupied. They might have been investor units that weren't actually occupied. And that why isn't this a situation we ought to look at, considering our concern for the straw man issue in West Park?
Because in this case, Your Honor, there is no evidence of a straw man situation. And we have to look at who bears the burden of proof on this issue. Sedona conceded, and Justice Douglas was talking about this earlier, in 2006 and 2007 that the units were occupied as apartments prior to their conversion and sale.
I'm not sure that was the extent of the concession. I think there might have been a concession that they were apartments, but I don't think there was a concession as to the level or extent of occupancy.
Well, what they conceded was, and this is their exact phrase, during Camden's involvement, the subject units were rented as apartments. They also conceded that pursuant to West Park, which defined a new residence as a residence that has remained unoccupied from the completion of construction until its sale as a condominium, they conceded that that's what the situation was here. So while they may not have actively come out and said it was occupied as opposed to their phrase using it was rented as an apartment, they were implicitly conceding and the court implicitly found that there was occupancy, because otherwise the court would not have made the determination that West Park, or that pursuant to West Park, these units did not qualify as new residences.
Counsel, fundamentally, I can't agree with you on that particular point. We were very clear in West Park and the case thereafter making a distinction as that term of art, occupancy, opposed to something merely on the rent rolls. But I think you were correct in terms of whose burden it was to produce that information.
And while I definitely appreciate that, I think it's 100% clear that at no point during 2000 and actually during the life of this case that Sedona has ever presented evidence to demonstrate that any of these units were not occupied. Now this concept of,
well, your own concessions indicated it seems to me like there was 96% of them that were truly occupied.
And those facts,
that still leaves a percentage that weren't.
And that percentage comes from a determination that was made after Camden's involvement in the case. Again, in 2008, when Camden was dismissed, all of the parties conceded that occupancy of these units wasn't an issue. Sedona expressly acknowledged these are common law claims. Pursuant to West Park, Chapter 40 does not apply to Camden. So when the court ruled on the motion to dismiss in 2008, and then subsequently in the Delta case, which you'll hear next, evidence was presented as to the exact extent of that occupancy, it still is 100% clear that Sedona has never demonstrated that that 4% that maybe is questionable actually remained unoccupied from its completion of construction until sale. So because under that, you know, that again, going to who bears the burden on this issue, where the trial court has already made factual determinations based upon both parties' agreement as to what the facts were, this court should not go back and revisit and revitalize and give Sedona a third, fourth bite at the apple. We've already seen, you don't need a crystal ball in this case to see what facts Sedona can present, because ultimately the trial court already gave them the opportunity to go back and present those facts, both in its motion for reconsideration as to Camden and then ultimately in the motion for summary judgment as to Delta. And Sedona never presented any evidence to meet its burden.
If we accept the position that the Chapter 40 issues are gone, what do we do with the common law and the economic loss?
At this point, Your Honor, I think it's clear that nobody, at least Sedona, has not asked this court to go back and revisit whether or not the economic loss doctrine still applies to common law construction defect actions. And I think it's clear that is still the rule in this state. This court reaffirmed it in the Terracon versus Mandalay Bay case, which was slightly different because it was not only common law claims, but it was also claims for commercial construction. But I don't necessarily concede that there is a difference here. Camden did build a commercial apartment complex at the time it was taking its actions in 1994 through 2004 of building what it believed was going to be a commercial complex at all times that would not be sold to the public. And that's an important distinguishing fact here, because Sedona is asking this court to go back, retroactively determine that Camden has liability either under Chapter 40 or breach of the implied warranties because of the actions of someone other than Camden. Camden had absolutely no involvement in the conversion and sale of these units to the public. It built a commercial apartment complex that would be between sophisticated commercial entities. Those parties were in a position to contractually weigh and the risks and benefits of building this building.
To a certain extent, though, they're also claiming that all these entities were one and the same. The failure of consideration among the different entities.
With all due respect, that's actually not an allegation in our case. That's an allegation related to Delta and HBC. There's no dispute that Camden is completely separate from Delta.
Well, counsel, within that same area, though, and it's been espoused by the court, the purpose of Chapter 40 is eventually to protect homeowners. And the area, and the court has talked about shams or other transfers that may meet legal definitions, have to be considered by this court as we review those things, because sophisticated builders and investors do certain things to skate the law, to put it in the gray area. We are conscious of that. So in this case, we are considering, even though it's on the outer parameters, what actually happened in this and what the parties did and what was before the court. We are concerned as to, as counsel has put forth, him wanting us to readopt this vertical privity. Whether we get there or not is a different issue. What do you say as to his arguments about the court using this case to change the privity lines?
I think there are a couple distinctions that have to be made out at the front. In this court's determination in Radiker, it adopted the implied warranty of habitability for the first time. in doing it, it did not only adopt the requirement that privity was there or must be there, it also required that a few other elements. The defendant had to be a builder vendor, meaning someone who built and sold this product to the public. It had to be a new residence that was built for purposes of resale. None of those elements are satisfied here. And I think if you take a look at the Utah Supreme Court's decision in 2009 in Davenport at Pilgrim's Landing, it did a comprehensive analysis of implied warranty law throughout the nation. It noted that the majority rule is still to require privity of contract. It is also noted that other than Arizona, no state has completely abandoned the requirement that a defendant also be a builder and vendor, which again, that's not the situation. While this court may be inclined to determine whether or not privity of contract should be abandoned, whether or not the builder-vendor requirement should be abandoned, this case simply doesn't present the compelling facts or any of the public policy arguments that would be applicable to that type of decision. Nobody disputes that Camden built at all times within its mind that it was going to be a commercial apartment complex between owned by sophisticated entities, not a new residence for sale to the public. And Sedona is asking this court to sit in the place.
Counsel, I hear that nice distinction you were making, but if I was to go back into the codes for building purposes and for habitable establishments, they don't make very many distinctions as to how it was built. It's built for habitable to be habitable. And so to be real frank, that argument I can't buy. But I understand your point of what their intention was in building.
And I think, while there may not be significant differences on the applicable code, there are significant differences on the liability that goes with building a commercial building versus a residential building.
But see, as you get into that argument, as we get in this slippery slope, as we looked at in West Park, we are talking about what happens, what is that transition, how does the original intent morph into another intent where it's built for this, as you're saying, commercial, and then during a period of time, if it's unoccupied or the same person, it slips over and becomes a something that's acceptable for Chapter 40. We have this little gray area.
But if you recall, in West Park, they were built as condominiums. That was the original intent. The builder built the first 36 units as condominiums, sold them as condominiums, then built the next 108 units, realized the market wasn't susceptible to selling those types of units, and as a result of the market change, made them into apartments until the market got better. That's not the situation here. At all times, Camden believed that this would be a commercial apartment complex, and it based its determinations on how to address things like liability.
Also, look, our liability is a liability as to whether or not there was a defect in the building of the establishments. That's ultimately where we are. We can play all the fictions you want, but that's where we are with that. But that is something we may not even need to get to in light of what the court actually did based on what was before the court. And that's why I ask you about the economic loss doctrine and the privity, which you've been going through, which is important for us to consider.
Certainly. And Your Honor, I think, again, the way a party deals with commercial liability is going to be in the form of their contract. The parties are going to agree to set out through their contract how that liability, assuming a defect actually exists, which has never been proven in this case. These are all just allegations. In a commercial setting, the party's contract is going to dictate how and who bears the liability and what extent that liability may exist. It's very common to find limitations of liability in commercial contracts. So in a situation where these two sophisticated commercial parties bargained for and determined and figured out who was going to bear which risk, going in after the fact, based upon actions taken by somebody entirely removed from that transaction, someone that didn't consult Camden in any sort of way in the decision to convert these units into units that would be sold to the party, it simply is just not something this court should go out of its way to do. This is not a compelling case on its facts where this court should take the type of action that would be necessary to go in and rewrite the law retroactively to a situation where all parties agree when Camden built this project, that law didn't apply. There was no Chapter 40 liability as to the apartment complex. There was no implied warranty of habitability as to an apartment complex. And the actions of a remote third party should not go in and retroactively change that. Now, briefly, Sedona's counsel mentioned the Hiles decision, and I just want to address a couple issues on that. The Hiles decision determined for the first time that in the context of the UCC, which is it implies warranty statutorily, privity of contract is not required. And again, while there may be reasons for that decision, an important key function of the UCC is that implied warranties can be contracted around. They can be waived. And in a situation where a party could have protected itself at the onset with its initial purchaser, the party that it initially contracted with, it could have required, as part of the negotiation, a waiver of future implied warranties, which would then bind the subsequent parties. And in a situation where you are judicially creating an implied warranty like Sedona is asking, that's just simply that opportunity to waive the implied warranties would never apply. I see that my time is up, so I respectfully request that the court affirm the 2008 dismissal of Camden for the reasons set forth today and in our briefs. Thank you.
Your Honors, just very, very briefly, what I would just point out is that, number one, the state of the law changes all the time. That's why we have courts. So a defense that, well, the law has changed and we couldn't have anticipated that does not seem like it would be an appropriate justification for this court not considering whether or not the law needs to evolve because of how factors have developed within society. And I think that the Arizona Supreme Court considered those sorts of things and said, listen, we understand that even because of contractual obligations, somebody might be out of business, somebody might be stuck with a responsibility they didn't anticipate. At the end of the day, the court concluded that the cost of remedying defective construction most appropriately falls on the builder rather than on the innocent.
Mr. Wright raised a string of cases or the review by the Utah Supreme Court, the Davenport case.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I think one has to look at each of those individually and in the context of what the law is within that particular state. And I think what's relevant about that is here in Nevada, given the Callaway versus Reno decision, if we adopt the requirement of privity, what we are doing is we're saying to people like the end buyers at Sedona, you essentially have no remedy. There's no way you could have anticipated this. We're talking about latent defects. But
was there ever an indication other than the concurrence in Callaway that we weren't going to require privity?
No. No, Your Honor, there's not. And with that, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I thank the parties for their arguments this day. As of this matter, it will stand submitted.